I'm Mark Simpson, and this is a special edition of Intersection. This week, 90.7 series Healthcare Reform in Central Florida looks at the impacts of President Obama's Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. On Intersection, we'll be talking about healthcare policy today, what that means for patients, doctors, hospitals, insurers, and Floridians. The changes ahead for the new healthcare policy are large and complex. To shine some light on the issues, I'm joined by an expert panel to explore policy and healthcare reform with a doctor, a hospital administrator, and an academic scholar. That conversation ahead on Intersection. And to help us explore what healthcare reform means for Central Florida, I'm joined by Randy Hartley. He is the Chief Administrative Officer of Nemours Children's Hospital here in Orlando. Randy, great to have you with us.
It's great to be here. Great to be here, Mark.
We're also joined by Dr. David Auerbach. He's a practicing physician and director of the Newborn Intensive Care Unit at the Winnie Palmer Hospital for Women and Babies. Dr. Auerbach, great to have you with us.
Thanks, Mark. Great to be here.
Joining us by phone, Jack Hoadley, professor in Georgetown University's Health Policy Institute. He's co-author of a study examining the Affordable Care Act and Florida's Medicaid choice, which was sponsored in part by the Winter Park Health Foundation, which is also providing support for this series. Jack, great to have you with us.
I'm happy to join you.
We're seeing Florida's Republican Governor Rick Scott and Republican-led lawmakers softening their stance on the Affordable Care Act in recent weeks, moving towards implementing it now. And I wonder, Randy Hartley, as a hospital administrator, does this have an impact on you and how you approach your job at your level? You've got to make plans for this now.
Our stance on it, it's simply the law of the land and where we're being postured to be prepared to respond for it. This represents the opening salvos of the war, if you will, to try to figure out how we're going to do health care in America. It represents primarily insurance reform. This is what the Affordable Care Act is primarily. There's other things which we need to do, but in terms of their stance on it, it's relatively transparent to us at the execution level. We're going to continue to take care of the parents and families of Central Florida, I'm sure all of the hospitals in the areas, and as we navigate through this and the interpretation of what this law is.
David Auerbach, you also deal with children from a very practical side, being a physician. I wonder, when you see that there's changes coming afoot, does it mean changes for you on the ground as the way you go about your daily business?
I see all comers. I take care of patients. I already have a population that's 65% Medicaid. So what Florida does with Medicaid in a more general sense becomes a little bit more important. But on a day-to-day basis, I'm still going to take care of the patient.
Jack Hoadley, what do you see looking at this from far away as Florida goes through its machinations? We're seeing Republican Governor Rick Scott making some changes, but he's not the only one out there. Is Florida unique in this situation?
No, Florida's not unique. There are lots of states that are trying to figure out exactly what to do in terms of implementing this new law. And one of the pieces that we took a look at in a recent study was to see what would be the impact of the one decision that the Supreme Court left open, which was to leave states a decision of whether to extend Medicaid coverage to some additional populations. And that's one of the ones where the governor has indicated some greater flexibility in the last couple of weeks than what he'd been saying before.
Well, I know a lot of Floridians are worried about the cost of Medicaid expansion and that the insurance exchanges that are part of this Affordable Care Act might be too much for the state or families, businesses to bear. And we do have a health care reform question of the day for our listeners, and I'll put that out to our panel right now. Should Florida be setting up its own insurance exchange or leave that to the federal government? And on that question of Medicaid, should the state opt into the Medicaid expansion? Jack Hoadley, you looked at this in your study. What's your analysis show?
Well, our analysis shows that there are some real advantages to the state of Florida for opting into the Medicaid expansion. The two big advantages are the number of people that will gain coverage, and we estimate that somewhere between 800,000 and 1.3 million adults and children in Florida would gain coverage if the state does this extension of Medicaid coverage. Most of these are people who would be newly eligible but does include some who are eligible today but might get caught up in the excitement over new coverage and finally sign up for a benefit that they're already eligible for. But we also took a look at the cost, because that's obviously important. And while there's some upfront cost to the state in doing this, the federal government is really picking up much of the tab, and there are some offsetting savings to the state. So we estimate that down the road that the state really is going to save money in net from extending Medicaid coverage. It's not, you know, the cost to the state for new coverage will be offset by some additional savings in programs that are operated today that now would be covered by some federal dollars. And so there's savings in the short term, and there's savings in the long term for this with this extension, we think.
By the way, I do want to add for our listeners, you can put in your own thoughts on that question. Go online to our Facebook page, and also you can let us know by Twitter. We're at WMFE Orlando. Randy, what do you think from what you're hearing there, if there's a Medicaid expansion, acknowledging that you already deal with a population that is involved with this, though, are you thinking that you're going to get a much larger influx of patients wanting to take advantage of the services a hospital like Nemours offers?
I think so. I mean, not just us, but any of the hospitals in town. Let me tell you what I find encouraging, and I want to piggyback on one of the things Jack said. What is crushing the system today is a dysfunctional, ununified system of care where people that don't have insurance coverage bounce from emergency room to emergency room to emergency room. They get episodic care. They get no preventive care. And that's incredibly expensive and incredibly stressful on not just the health care business, but the finance business. A part of this, a big part of getting people covered, is that you can engage them in preventive services, and you can get them in and get them treated at a much lower cost than waiting until something becomes a train wreck and they come to the emergency department. So I agree with Jack. I think the fact that you put your arms around more people, get them impaneled, and treat them from a prevention side, I think it can be a big boon to the state. Right now, that cost gets done and passed on to everybody indirectly.
Now, what do you hear from other colleagues dealing with other hospitals? Is your situation unique, and other hospitals are looking at this in a much more of a potential crisis coming ahead?
Well, I can't speak for the other hospitals, but I can give you one small data point from where I come. I came to Nemours Children's Hospital from an adult acute care system, a faith-based system, which has had a significant Medicaid cohort, upwards of 65-70%. The changes that they have made in the Medicaid reimbursement to address programmatic issues with the budget have been extremely challenging for those hospitals. I would expect all of the adult acute care hospitals are. We get a little bit of a break because the standalone children's hospitals in Florida, as of yet, have been a little bit of exempt from those cutbacks.
David Auerbach, talk to me about this kind of fundamental shift that implementers hope that this Affordable Care Act will have, which is changing to more emphasis on preventative medicine as opposed to coming in when there is a crisis point in needing health care.
Yeah, I think from a policy perspective, the direction of this is to take care of a population and to improve access to care with an emphasis on preventive care. If you prevent some of the problems and you don't deal with it, as Randy mentioned, in an episodic and highly expensive way, you have some savings there and you get a healthier population. I mean, from my perspective, while I'm going to take care of the babies who are born, who are sick or premature, in a very practical way, my care improves if there's some continuity. So the pregnancy can be managed, the problem pregnancy can be identified, it can be managed before the baby's ever born. In order to have that happen, people have to have access to care. Now, simply because they have insurance doesn't guarantee that. And in the state of Florida, for a long time, there's been a system called the Regionalized Perinatal Intensive Care Centers, which we're one of. But this offers some additional opportunities to cover a greater population, get people into the system, have an emphasis on health rather than on things that could be have to be fixed afterward.
You mentioned that just because you have the insurance doesn't always necessarily mean people are going to use it. Do you think there's a psychological shift there that has to happen, a change culturally in terms of how we approach, even as users of the healthcare system?
Well, I think that there is a great misunderstanding out there about what healthcare insurance really is. And I think part of where the act is attempting to go in setting parameters is to say, okay, what does coverage represent? What are you getting for what you're putting into it? And there has to be an understood value proposition for people. And people who have not had that coverage may not see it that way, and it may take a while to get there.
Go ahead, Randy.
Mark, I got a follow-up question that a piggyback comment I want to make. And I'd be interested very much in both David and Jack's thoughts on this. I think the 800-pound gorilla that's in the room that we don't talk about regarding the Affordable Care Act is who's going to take care, who's going to provide these primary care services for this anywhere between, 46 to 53 million Americans that all of a sudden now have some type of coverage who've been getting episodic discontinuous coverage in the ED or care. And I think that's one of the huge challenges facing us with this, is that where are the primary care physicians, the general pediatricians, and the general interns going to come from to do that?
Part of this because we're seeing a trend in medical schools, people opting not to go into primary care and maybe go in a specialty area that you can make more money, pay off those big student loans. Well, let's put it to Jack Hoadley there. Jack, you're our scholar. Tell us, where are we hoping that these primary care physicians might come from, and is Florida prepared to expand that as needed?
Well, that really is one of the challenges that the system's going to face. But there's one step that's being taken to maybe try to help make primary care more attractive, and this is a short-term step and will have to be followed up for the longer term. But starting next year, this new law includes higher reimbursements to doctors who are providing primary care services in Medicaid, basically brings the Medicaid payment rates up to the Medicare payment rates. And those may not be as high as private rates, but they're still a lot better than what Medicaid is paying today. And so that's something that can happen right away and begin to try to fix to some degree the balance between how primary care doctors are paid and other doctors are paid. And that's one of the things that might help to address this question of encouraging medical students to think about primary care as a more important route.
David Auerbach, as you talk with colleagues, other doctors in the field, I mean, are doctors acknowledging that this is a potential roadblock ahead, trying to simply have enough people to provide that care as the demand fits?
Well, I think there's a great concern out there as to where the primary care providers are going to come from. And again, like a lot of things, if you're trying to re-engineer a system, it's going to take some time to make a difference. And I think that looking at people's behavior in this from a financial incentive perspective only captures part of it. There have been changes in medical education that would say, what does it take to go into this into this arena? And what you'd like from people going into medicine ultimately is a commitment and a passion to provide care for people. And making this attractive needs to be, I think, a little bit more than simply built on a financial reward.
You are listening to Intersection on 90.7 WMFE-FM. We're talking about the Affordable Care Act as part of 90.7's week-long special series, Healthcare Reform in Central Florida. What does it mean here in Central Florida for this community? Our guest, Randy Hartley, Chief Administrative Officer of Nemours Children's Hospital, David Auerbach, practicing physician and director of the Newborn Intensive Care Unit at the Winnie Palmer Hospital for Women and Babies. Joining us by phone is Jack Hoadley, a professor in Georgetown University's Health Policy Institute. I'm Mark Simpson. You touched on time, Dr. Auerbach, and I wonder, what do you think, Jack Hoadley? 2013 is right around the corner as we speak, and January 1st, 2014 is when this system of universal coverage is supposed to be taking effect. Is there enough time for the kind of changes we're hearing Dr. David Auerbach talk about to take effect both in Florida and on a national level?
Well, it is a tight timetable, but there certainly is time to make some of these things happen. And in many ways, what we're talking about are things that will just start to happen in 2014. What does happen immediately is the eligibility for new coverage, both the new Medicaid coverage we've been talking about, but also the new coverage through the insurance exchanges. And whether Florida does its own exchange or whether there's a federally run exchange, there will be an exchange up and running in 2014. So that new coverage will start to be ready. And it's going to be a lot has to happen to make that work. some of the other changes that really start to restructure how care is delivered, you know, that's a gradual process. That's happening already to some degree and will continue to happen over time. And that's an evolution, you know, more emphasis on the proper kind of treatment to avoid that recycling of patients from one emergency room to another that one of your guests was talking about. That's something that everybody can work on, but will have to improve over a longer period of time.
I wonder, what do you think, panel, in terms of the direction the state of Florida should go? Obviously, the legislature is going to be wrestling with how to create an exchange for Florida. But do you see any advantage to allowing the federal government to do it, to have a partial state-federal partnership there, or have the state go whole hog on it? What are your initial thoughts, knowing what you do about the healthcare industry? I'll put it to you, Randy.
Well, I think in terms of the model, I think the jury's still out because we don't know exactly what model they're going to come out with. I mean, I think all health services administrators and medical professionals would want the most efficient and lowest overhead model we could provide so that the dollars that this frees up actually go to prevention and take care of kids and families. That's what the focus is. So I'm not sure really we have. I think from an operational standpoint, I don't care who runs it as long as it is efficient and we see the resources going to where the need is.
What do you think, Dr. David Arbuckle?
Well, I think in the face of uncertainty, actions are being taken to try and position healthcare providers to deal with this one way or another. By that I mean if you're a hospital-based system and you know that this is going to involve a whole lot more of primary care providers, hospitals are reaching out to primary care providers and saying, hey, let's build a relationship with you, a referral relationship, relationship that gets your patients into the hospital when they need to and gets them back to you when it's appropriate, and we begin to build a little bit more seamless system to deal with that. Now, that's quite different from actually how this is going to be paid for. And so regardless, if you will, in terms of what the final funding mechanism is, I think there's an opportunity here, as was said, to see, you know, to push an evolution of a system that did not necessarily grow up with this in mind.
Mm-hmm. That this is a bit of a triage approach to this, right? This is not an organic evolution is what you're saying, it sounds like.
Well, I think that what ends up happening is as you start to change your process, you begin to understand, what are the issues here? What did we not think of? What makes sense? And that's something that's going to have an effect on where people who are in the middle of this want their funding to address. But, both these things have a kind of back-and-forth interaction.
Jack Hoadley, there's been a lot of trepidation, it seems like, from states around the country. Not that many have a system that's up and ready to go. I'm trying to recall an NPR report. I think I heard that maybe only one state or so has tackled doing the Medicaid the healthcare exchange on its own. So what are you thinking are the best options from the Florida perspective?
The numbers are a little greater than that. I mean, they're about I think somewhere in the range of 20 states that have committed to building their own exchanges and others still undecided.
But only I think my point, I think there was only one maybe that actually has it ready to go with the original deadlines.
Well, I mean, you know, ready to go now versus ready to go in the fall of next year, which is when they need to be. I mean, that's the key point.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a decision, you know, this decision of whether the federal government runs the exchange or whether the state runs the exchange. There's advantages to the state in making more of the decisions over how an exchange would work, and it gets a little more control if it decides to run it. But from the consumer's point of view, it's going to look pretty much the same whichever way it's run. There's going to be a set of Florida-based insurers that offer insurance to people through an exchange, through a marketplace that allows them to consider what kind of insurance they want to buy. And then they buy insurance from, you know, a local insurer. And that's the bottom line for the citizens, regardless of how the exchange is run. You know, as we talked about before, the Medicaid expansion is really the more important open question, because if that doesn't occur, then a lot of people are really left in the lurch without a source of coverage.
And I do want to say, you mentioned insurers. I want to let our listeners know, we did try to reach out to insurers, and there's a lot of trepidation there. People not sure they want to talk about this yet because, again, there's a lot of uncertainty, and people don't know exactly how it's going to come together. David Auerbach.
Well, I think one of the things that insurers are going to deal with, regardless of how this shapes up, is what are the products that they want to offer? If you're having people buy in an exchange type of situation, having the ability to compare one product with another becomes important. And I think one of the things that you've seen happen recently is some rules issued that say, hey, this is the basic, and this is what you need if you want to go beyond that. And having talked directly to at least one Florida insurer, I get the sense that they are going to have a whole bunch of products out there trying to deal with one or another set of consumer needs.
Now,
the other thing is that Florida already has a program underway when it comes to Medicaid to turn Medicaid into more of an HMO product. And Florida has sought a federal exemption to be able to pursue this pilot project. It functions in five counties in Florida. Now, how Medicaid HMOs, in the way the state envisioned them before this all came about, how that's going to play out in this arena is another complication. And I don't think anybody has a good sense of that.
Jack Hoadley, I think you touched on an interesting question there, funding and cost in terms of Medicaid expansion, the big choice maybe facing Florida. We've heard big concerns from Governor Rick Scott about how much this Medicaid expansion might cost for the state, how much it might actually add up to. What is your take on the numbers, and where's that money come from?
Yeah, we took a look at the numbers, and the state has actually reduced some of the estimates they had originally put out about how much this would cost to pick up the new folks who would become eligible. And we do see, when you sort of look at a year, down the road, the federal government picks up 100% of the cost for the first 3 years of the expansion. And then that share reduces to 90%, but it's still 90% of the cost. And so while we see new state cost, if you look at a year, say around 2018 or 2020, new state cost annually of about $600 million, but we also see offsetting savings to the states of about $700 million for a net state savings of $100 million. And so, there really isn't a matter of looking where to pick up the cost for these programs, because the costs are being paid today. They're being paid when the state runs separate mental health service programs, when the state helps to provide support for uncompensated care, when the hospital treats a person with no insurance, when the state provides Medicaid coverage through the state's Medically Needy program. These aren't programs that are going to go away, but they're programs whose costs will become less because those same people that are being served by those programs today would now have coverage either through the insurance exchanges or through the new Medicaid expansion.
I think it's going to be interesting to see what happens in Tallahassee because we've seen other federal programs come through where the federal government was going to be paying in large part for programs. I'm thinking transportation, maybe a high-speed rail, and the state was later going to pick up more as that tab went on, and that wasn't enough to convince Rick Scott. I mean, he's changing his tune a little bit on this, but certainly a tough song to sing in the halls of Tallahassee. Go ahead, Randy.
I think both panelists hit on a really important point here. There's a lot of money being spent right now, okay, but it's being spent in a non-managed way, and it's episodic, and it's not continuous, and it's just bad ways to take care of enrolled populations and do a population health mission. I think if this act succeeds, if it does succeed to extend primary care and to get prevention services, I think we will see a significant reduction of health care expenditures. But the devil's in the details and the devil's in the execution. If that does not happen, I'm not real optimistic that this will succeed in the long run.
And for primary care to have a long-term impact, you got to wait a little bit to see, hey, if we take care of somebody at this point in this way and emphasize health, what chronic diseases are they not going to have down the line? So this becomes, if you will, an investment in the future, and you have to have some faith that your assumptions are going to play out the way you think they were going to play out.
I wonder, just briefly, Randy Hartley, Nemours Children's Hospital is part of this new Orlando Medical City complex, a big component of diversifying this area's economy. How do you think the Affordable Care Act affects Medical City as a whole, with you being one of the primary tenants down there?
Well, I think it does a couple things for us. I mean, the whole vision, and it's not just tied to Medical City. It's the consolidation and the integration and the construction of integrated healthcare systems. David talked about how hospitals are acquiring primary care networks to offer an integrated system to take care from prevention to counseling all the way up through tertiary care if needed be. The vision of Medical City is to engage private, federal, and state resources at the same location to find a new, efficient way of doing things. We're having discussions about something as simple as laboratory equipment between Stanford Burnham Medical Research Institute, the College of Medicine of UCF, and the Veterans Administration. We all do not need an electron microscope. Okay, I mean everybody doesn't need one. If we can procure one, okay, and set up a way for all of the Medical City partners to work for that, that is more efficient. And that is the impetus behind the Affordable Care Act, is to make healthcare more efficient. But we don't have a monopoly on that in Medical City. All healthcare systems are trying to find a way to consolidate overhead, reduce expenditures that don't directly impact the patient care and provide continuity.
Well, this law is certainly large and complex, and there's many issues and answers still to come. I want to get from our panelists before we go here, what is the primary takeaway you'd like to leave listeners with as far as how the Affordable Care Act will affect patients? I'll start with you, Dr. David Auerbach.
Well, I think that people are going to have a choice about what their coverage is. I think they will need to look at that carefully. I think they need to be thinking in general about what their health is and not just what the problems are. And I think that this is an area of great uncertainty at this point. Best thing I can say is stay tuned.
Stay tuned. What do you say, Randy?
I certainly agree with David on that standpoint. You know, we've been trying to do this in this nation for almost 47 years, okay? The act as it's passed is not substantially different than the proposed legislation in the 1960s. I think it's important for listeners to understand this is step one of trying to get our healthcare system where it needs to be. This bill, as I mentioned earlier, this law is an insurance reform law primarily. There needs to be tort reform law, and there needs to be medical reform. We as a profession need to do things better, more efficiently. So I think we shouldn't look at this as a silver bullet for the American healthcare system, but I think it's a decent start.
And Jack Hoadley, your final thoughts.
Yeah, I think I agree with my fellow panelists that a lot of what we're talking about here is not the cost of the system, but really the transformation of the system that this potentially represents. And while there's a lot of work that has to happen to get there, you know, there were some recent studies that looked at extensions of Medicaid coverage that have happened in some states over recent years. And the result was, for comparing before to after, that mortality decreased, that health status improved. People get healthier when they have health coverage and they take care of themselves and they get in and get the primary care. And so I think it's really important to emphasize the health impact and not always have this be a discussion about costs.
Mm-hmm. I've been speaking with Jack Hoadley. He's professor at Georgetown University's Health Poly Institute. With us in studio, David Auerbach, practicing physician and director of the Newborn Intensive Care Unit at the Winnie Palmer Hospital for Women and Babies, and also Randy Hartley, Chief Administrative Officer of Nemours Children's Hospital. Gentlemen, thank you all.
Thank you very much, Mark.
Thank you.
Don't forget, you can also share your thoughts on 90.7's Healthcare Question of the Day online at Facebook and Twitter, and visit WMFE.org to take part in our Healthcare Priorities poll. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners. Amy Green is assistant producer. I'm Mark Simpson, and thanks for listening.